This is a download from the BBC. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
If you look at the consequences of doing nothing, my concern is that if in 20 years' time unabated climate change is pretty bad and we see that sea levels are rising and that the polar ice has melted and that there's no more glaciers in Switzerland and that New York is underwater, we might actually think, you know what, we've got to do something. Surely we've got to do something.
Engineer Hugh Hunt from Cambridge University is one of a small band of researchers who think we should be looking for something effective to reduce global warming. Ideally, they'd like us to change our habits and use fewer fossil fuels. But in case that doesn't happen, they say we need an insurance policy. Professor David Keith of Harvard University.
The balance of evidence from climate models and from basic theory and observation suggests that doing some of this so-called solar geoengineering, putting reflective particles like sulfuric acid in the upper stratosphere, could significantly reduce climate risks for the whole world over the next, say, half century, reducing the risks to ecosystems, say, to the high Arctic, or to people who will see crop failures from heat stress. There are lots of problems, to be sure, and lots of good reasons not to talk about it. But the core reason to take it seriously is just that. It looks like it really could reduce the risks.
Geoengineering is a deliberate intervention in the climate system to counteract man-made global warming, according to the Royal Society, which published a seminal report on the subject in 2009. The Royal Society Committee concluded that although emissions reductions should be the priority, geoengineering may be a useful addition. You could call it a technical fix for one of the biggest problems of our age. I'm Gaia Vince, and in this edition of Frontiers, I'll be exploring one aspect of geoengineering, solar radiation management, which aims to cool the planet by reflecting more sunlight back into space. I'll be talking to the researchers who are thinking seriously about this approach and trying to work out whether it's technically feasible. But there are considerable social and political issues raised by geoengineering, which they are only too aware of. Dr. Rose Cairns of Sussex University.
While the natural scientists and physical scientists are interested in questions around feasibility of these kinds of technologies and kind of questions of risk or impacts, the kinds of questions that we're interested in, we're a team of social, political, kind of legal and ethical specialists, as it were. And we're looking at questions like, would climate control be something that societies would even want, even if it were possible? So can we imagine a socially just and democratic way in which these techniques could be carried out? So some people have talked about the kind of metaphor of the thermostat to make the point. And so if you're imagining if it were possible to create a global thermostat, whose hand would be on that thermostat?
Scientists have suggested a variety of ways of solar radiation management. We could put giant mirrors into space to reflect the sunlight or paint all the roofs white, for example. And these were considered in the Royal Society report. One idea that's being taken increasingly seriously is pumping sulphur into the atmosphere. It might seem crazy to release sulphur, which is usually considered a pollutant, but it's inspired by a process that happens naturally.
In the Philippines, the Mount Pinatubo volcano has erupted, throwing rocks and molten lava miles into the air. Officials say it's no longer safe to be within 18 miles of the volcano. A huge mushroom cloud forming in the sky is clearly visible from Manila, 60 miles away.
A column of molten rock, boiling mud and volcanic ash shoots thousands of feet in the air as Mount Pinatubo continues to erupt after 600 years...
Dr. Matt Watson of Bristol University studies volcanoes and is part of the Stratospheric Particle Injection for Climate Engineering Project, better known as the SPICE Project.
Volcanoes produce a gas called sulfur dioxide that can be injected to quite high altitudes, maybe 30, 35 kilometres or sometimes even higher. And what happens is that sulfur dioxide over time reacts with water and oxygen and forms very small particles called sulfate aerosol, and they're quite reflective. And so what happens after a volcanic eruption is that you have what's called a sulfate aerosol layer, and that reflects probably 1% to 2% of incoming radiation from the sun back out into space, and that simply alters the Earth's energy budget by enough to cool the planet. And we know this happens because we've made very good observations of relatively recent large eruption in 1991, Mount Pinatubo, and what we saw there was a global cooling of somewhere between half a degree and a degree Celsius for about 2 years. So we know in principle that actually if we increase the amount of sulfate in the atmosphere, the global temperature would drop.
But do we have any idea how much sulfate was emitted by Pinatubo?
Actually, that's one of the things that I can speak to as something of an expert in, that I co-wrote a paper in 2004 that captured all of the observations around Pinatubo and worked out that the total amount of SO2 emitted in only 6 hours, I hasten to add, was about 20 million tonnes. So we know broadly from a point source near the equator, 20 million tonnes is about enough to knock about half a degree off global temperature.
But how on earth could you get sulphur tens of kilometres high into the atmosphere? David Keith, who's been thinking about geoengineering for decades, reckons it could actually be rather simple.
It actually turns out to be not extraordinary. So in the scale of what nowadays is hard engineering, so if you go and talk with aerospace companies that make their business of it, and I don't just mean the biggest ones in the world, but this would be true of Embraer or Hindustani Aeronautics or what have you, the kind of thing that would be needed simply to do this is actually quite what they almost call commercial off the shelf. It's something that they could quite easily engineer with no massive leap. So whereas if you ask them to build a cheap supersonic transport or a Mach 6 aircraft, they really don't know how to do it. This could be done with a pretty simple modifications of existing business jets can, in a cost-effective way, get materials up to the required altitude.
So how would you feasibly take the sulfate and inject them into the stratosphere? 20 kilometres are we talking? How high?
20 is a reasonable altitude, and the answer is modified versions of commercial business jets with different engines will do that. We worked with an aerospace firm that did a design study. From their point of view, this was not on the hard end of what companies do.
In the UK, the SPICE project has a different approach. Hugh Hunt is another of its members. His area of expertise is vibration, which is a big problem up in the stratosphere.
The technology that we're exploring is the idea of tethered balloons. So you could imagine a big balloon up at 20 kilometres, helium-filled or hydrogen-filled balloon, holding up a glorified garden hose, and that we'd pump the particles directly up the hose. We just don't know if this technology is at all feasible. And one of the issues really is that were we to decide in 20 years' time or whenever it might be that we actually do need to do some geoengineering because sea levels are rising rapidly or the poles are melting, we ought to check whether the technology is viable or not.
What's the highest that anybody's ever got one of these balloons to go before with a pipe hanging off the end of it?
Well, no one's actually pumped anything. I mean, it's not the sort of thing you really would want to do for any particular reason. The highest that people have gone with a tethered balloon, i.e. a balloon on the end of a string, is of the order of 3 or 4 kilometres, 5 kilometres perhaps. Once you get to around 10 kilometres, the winds get very, very high. That's where the jet stream is. And it's almost impossible to consider flying a balloon at that altitude. One of the big challenges would be then, how would we launch a big balloon and this pipe through the very windy atmosphere at around 10 kilometres?
So the other side of 10 kilometres, once you get past that, it's calmer again, is it?
It's calmer.
In 2011, the SPICE project was all set to carry out a world-first test of the technology, spraying water from a balloon at a height of a kilometre. But for a variety of reasons, including opposition from geoengineering protest groups, it was cancelled.
We were going to put a balloon up at 1 kilometre. And in fact, the technical challenge to do that is, that's been done often. There's no particular technical challenge there. The reason for doing it was so that we could look at the way that the pipe would be affected by wind. We were particularly interested, and we still are particularly interested, in how the wind causes the pipe to vibrate and to move around. Our 1 kilometre test attracted quite a lot of attention, and our motives for doing the test, which was to look at the vibration of the tether in the wind, I don't think people believed us that was what we were trying to do. In the end, it was just easier for us not to bother doing that test because it wasn't that important to us. The good thing is that it did attract quite a lot of attention, and it has focused the debate quite nicely. And I think it's really important that we have discussions like the one we're having right now, so that the technology is seen to be out there and being talked about, and that it's not a technology which is being developed without consideration for the governance and ethics and public engagement issues, because they're very important. And it's very important that we look at the what you might call the unintended consequences. And it's important that we look at the unintended consequences of unabated climate change as well.
And perhaps not surprisingly, there are likely to be other effects on the climate if we put sulfate into the stratosphere. From studying volcanoes, Matt Watson says there could be an impact on the ozone layer, which protects us from dangerous UV light.
We see ozone loss at the poles after volcanic eruptions. And the way that works is that these little aerosol particles act as catalysts. And on the surface of these particles are made chemicals which then might go on to destroy ozone. And so part of my work and the work of the people in my team is to, in various labs across the country, look at the likely effects of ozone on different particles, but also on sulfate, in order to tell us what the likely effect of ozone depletion might be. The problem with volcanoes as analogues is they are sporadic point source injections, and they're very short-term, right? So we've talked about Pinatubo injecting over 6 hours. That's not a perfect analogue to repeatedly pumping lower levels of SO2 into the stratosphere for years and years and years and years and years. So while volcanoes have a profound effect on ozone, the ozone layer does recover relatively quickly after a volcanic eruption. But there is this question about, you know, if you commit to geoengineering for the long term, what does it do to ozone depletion?
Critics of solar radiation management say it will reduce rainfall in some parts of the world. David Keith argues that it isn't that clear-cut.
A very common claim about these technologies, maybe the most common claim, is that it would produce drought specifically in India. And this is not actually really backed up by the science. There are two things. One is, it matters how much of this you do. So a lot of the simulations have been done for reasons that are kind of arbitrary and have nothing to do with sound public policy, have assumed that what we would do is use these technologies to return the surface temperature of the Earth to the pre-industrial, a sudden cooling. And if you do that, the precipitation goes down below pre-industrial. It's almost certain that that is, to put a polite word to it, nuts. And nobody I know actually advocates that as policy. But a bunch of the simulations have shown that. And of course, they show reduction in precipitation. But if you take the same simulations and the same models and put in a more moderate amount of this geoengineering, what you can do is prevent a rise in precipitation, but you don't have to make it fall. So there's nothing inherent in these things that mean precipitation falls. And to be clear, precipitation has to be balanced by evaporation. So there's nothing here that says that there would necessarily be droughts.
These predictions come from computer models of the future climate. They reveal one of the more worrying aspects of doing solar radiation management. What happens if we stop it? Dr. Naomi Vaughan from the University of East Anglia.
If it is stopped at any point, the temperature rises very, very rapidly, much, much, much more quickly than we've seen with climate change. And that rapid rate of temperature is potentially more damaging than allowing climate change to happen more slowly and more gradually. And that is a real concern. It's called the termination effect. It was mentioned in the Royal Society report. There's been a recent modelling study that has taken all of the world's best big global models of how the climate works. About 8 or 9 of them were taken where they simulated a future where they put the solar geoengineering in, and then they stopped it suddenly. And all of the models had rapid rates of warming that would be far, far more damaging than the gradual rate of change. And this termination effect is a real issue with the safety of solar geoengineering.
In the UK, running parallel to the technical research are two social science projects looking into the thorny questions of ethics and governance of geoengineering. Usually, science comes up with new controversial developments and the public don't hear about them until the research is done. Think of genetic engineering or nuclear power. Naomi Vaughan, one of the researchers looking at the social aspects of geoengineering, has been finding out what the public think of the idea. It turns out that most people know very little about the subject, so they're invited in for a day to learn about it.
You provide them with some of the information, And it doesn't take very much information providing before people can start to critique and to have an opinion and have an understanding of what these geoengineering technologies might be like, where their problems might be. And so generally, we have found in both of those streams of work, the work with the University of Cardiff, as well as the work with a PhD student here, Rob Bellamy, we've found that when we look at geoengineering options as a possible response to climate change, and we also talk about the other possible responses to climate change, reducing our emissions mitigation or adapting to the changes brought by climate change, that people, they generally prefer emissions reduction options. So they prefer mitigation options over geoengineering options. That's the main result from Rob's work. So they prefer steps such as low carbon living and behavioural change and offshore wind energy, options like that, options that reduce our emissions are preferred generally to ideas of solar geoengineering like stratospheric aerosols, or ideas of carbon geoengineering or carbon dioxide removal such as air capture and storage or biochar.
But we've had decades now where people have been told of the dangers of climate change, the very real dangers of climate change, and they've been told what should be done to reduce emissions. And yet we've found over the last few decades that people haven't reduced their emissions. Instead, the emissions have gone up. I'm just wondering how that works with your research. So if people are told about geoengineering and given the options, they still go for emissions reduction. And yet we don't see that in the general populace. We don't see emissions reduction.
We do find that people prefer emissions reduction. And the main reason for that is that emissions reduction deals with the root cause of climate change. It deals with what's causing climate change. And especially the solar geoengineering is not seen as dealing with it. And that's because it isn't. It isn't addressing the increased atmospheric CO2 concentrations, the increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere because of our emissions of primarily CO2, but also other greenhouse gases. There was also another perspective we came across where people saw these ideas of geoengineering, and especially the solar geoengineering. And they said, if this is what scientists are looking at, if this is what people are thinking about, then this climate change must be a real problem. And, you know, I must need to do more on my mitigation. And towards the end of the day, often the conversation would come around about reducing emissions and what things people could do in their own homes.
So ironically, telling people about geoengineering may make them more likely to use fewer fossil fuels. Dr. Rose Cairns at the University of Sussex is looking into how the world might decide when and if geoengineering should be implemented. One of the sticky questions is the fine line between research and deployment.
Fundamental to questions of governance is this question of whether it is, in fact, when you're talking about climate engineering, whether it's meaningful to make a distinction between research and deployment, which is what a lot of scientists that you might talk to are very keen to draw a distinction and say, well, what we're doing is just research at this point. And while that's understandable, because a lot of the things that are going along, in sense of modelling or in labs, but whether or not that is actually a meaningful distinction to draw is something that we're looking at. So although there may not be very big physical impacts on the kind of natural environment or kind of other natural systems of the kind of work that's going on at the moment, the kind of research that's going on, there may well be kind of social impacts and political impacts of that research. So there's been, looking through the kind of history of technology, there's this idea that if you spend money, rarely does society actually spend money kind of mobilising and spending money on research to develop technologies that are then just sort of put on the shelf, as it were. So there's this idea that actually by doing research, you build up a momentum in a certain direction. And this has been referred to as a so-called slippery slope argument, which basically, if we continue to put energy and resources into even just researching some of these techniques, their eventual deployment becomes much more likely. We're sort of we're locked into a particular pathway of technological development. So quite a lot of our work is looking at potentially trying to learn from other technologies, whether it might be looking at nuclear or whether it might be looking at other kinds of technologies, about the kinds of ways in which commitments get built, political commitments, economic commitments and so on, around particular technologies, and whether that actually kind of locks you in to a particular technological pathway.
Mankind isn't particularly good at developing technology it doesn't then use. And so if you get to the point where you research and develop technology to do this deployment, that makes it more tempting. And that is actually something I think we have to also be worried about. I think the way forward is a middle ground, which is very, very careful, transparent well-governed research, and I mean governance at an early stage.
And what mechanisms are in place now to look at governance and to look at how deployment might take place in a societal way?
Well, there are very few formal governance architectures in place. There are broadly two that have existed for a while. The first of which is called NMOD, which is a treaty about weather modification as an act of war, which has been ratified by pretty much everybody, and that makes that illegal. And there's a second thing called the Convention for Biodiversity, which is a legal instrument that prevents geoengineering deployment if it has a profound effect on biodiversity. The first of those two is a rather strong legal instrument, the second one of which is rather weak.
There have been calls for a UN body to regulate geoengineering. So what happens next? In the US, David Keith is working on an experiment to take a small amount of sulphur up into the atmosphere.
If we went forward with an experiment that we're right now going to the US government about, then it's an experiment that would release, by the way, something like a kilogram of sulphur, so less than a few minutes flight of a normal commercial aircraft. That would still be regulated by a whole series of environmental laws, very sensible ones, that regulate the potential environmental impacts of any federally funded activity. And we would, in fact, file an environmental impact statement under those laws, and it would get a serious look, and there'd be room for legitimate so-called interveners, people who think this experiment is misguided, to have their say and perhaps prevent it. So I would say that there is actually, in a country like the U.S., and it would be the same in Europe or Canada, substantial law that governs the way this works. And I don't think that law is sufficient. I think that we are going to need eventually some kind of large-scale international law, certainly to govern deployment of these technologies and maybe even to govern some kinds of large-scale research.
In Bristol, Matt Watson is looking at other materials that could replace sulfur, reflecting heat into space, but without damaging the ozone layer.
The serious ones that we're looking at are based around silica, alumina, titania. And unsurprisingly, there isn't a perfect particle. There isn't a particle that does all three things that we want. So somewhat depressingly, if you're pro-geoengineering and pro-deployment, there doesn't seem to be a particle that's particularly good physically, i.e. in terms of how it interacts with light, and chemically. The best one at the moment, I would suggest, of the particles we've looked at is a compound called silicon carbide. That certainly has the lowest impact on ozone that we've seen so far, but it doubtless has other problems that we haven't yet encountered.
And yet, there may be another way to control solar radiation that doesn't involve spraying particles to such incredible heights. Professor Stephen Salter of Edinburgh University is best known for his work on generating wave energy. Now he's turned his attention to geoengineering and he's devised a way to make certain clouds whiter so that they reflect more rays.
Well, we only spray at about 20, 25, 30 metres. It's then mixed by turbulence. The drops that we spray will evaporate quite quickly and leave a tiny little salt residue. And the salt residues are blown around by the variable directions and velocities in the bottom of the boundary layer. And the ones that manage to get, by chance, to the top of the clouds increase the number of drops in the cloud. And there's a well-known bit of physics called the Toomey effect, which says that if you have a large number of small drops, then you get a white cloud. And for the same amount of water, it's whiter than a small number of big drops. And we know that really because we know that when it's going to rain, the bottom of the clouds look very dark and black, and we say the dark storm clouds are gathering.
So this sounds very, very local. I mean, it sounds almost controllable that you can decide where you can cool the land or the ocean and you can decide where the rain falls.
That's right. We may be able to make wet places a bit drier and dry places a bit wetter by choosing where and when we do the spraying. The effects can actually be a long way away. It can be even the other side of the world.
And have you looked at the figures? Have you worked out sort of how much of this ocean spraying into the clouds you would need to do to, say, reduce global temperatures by half a degree?
Well, the numbers that we have are trying to go back to where we were in pre-industrial times, going back a couple of hundred years. And to do that, we'd need to be spraying about 10 cubic metres of water a second for the whole world.
Permanently?
All the time, yes, all the time. Once you built the stuff, you may as well keep using it. So that's not too bad. It's not using any fuel.
And you're imagining ships going past spraying this with towers. I've seen some of the pictures.
Yeah, well, the ships are cruising around. They're driven by the wind, and they're dragging generating plant through the water to make the energy that they need. And this is used to make the spray. And we will direct them where we think we need to have them. We like to have them in whichever hemisphere has got the summer. And then we want to migrate them around to the other hemisphere when the seasons change. And we would need about 300 of them to offset the damage that we've done since pre-industrial times. And we might need a couple of thousand of them if we were to go on releasing CO2 but wanted to keep the temperatures right. So it's a few hundred to a few thousand ships to do this. I think the displacement now is 90 tonnes, so they're not very big ships. And we think they will cost about $2 million each. And they'll last about 25 years.
Stephen Salter's still working on the design, so we'll have to wait to see if his 300 unmanned ships will ever take to the ocean. Some of these geoengineering experiments to cool the planet may happen in the next few years, or they may remain as fantastical designs. Despite working at the cutting edge of an exciting new field, none of the scientists I spoke to actually want to put their designs into practice. They would far rather society solve the problem through mitigation. As we continue to emit greenhouse gases, knowing as we do how they change the climate, in a sense we are already geoengineering Earth. Solar radiation management won't solve the cause of the problem, and it will do nothing to counteract the ocean acidification effect of our carbon emissions. But the predicament that we find ourselves in, facing catastrophic climate change and yet increasingly reliant on the fuels that cause the problem, means that planetary cooling techniques are likely to be seriously considered. Geoengineering may be a valuable way of buying time while societies decarbonise, adapt to new conditions, and figure out an effective and efficient way of removing the carbon dioxide we've put into the atmosphere. As the scientists say, it's better to be prepared.
No one is in favour of geoengineering. My thinking is really it's more of an insurance policy than anything else. We hope never to use a fire engine. We hope that our house won't burn down. But we like the idea that the fire engines are ready just in case.
It's pretty horrible to work on things that you hope never happen. You know, if we ever actually do this for real, it'll be the clearest indication that we've basically failed miserably as a species.
If you've enjoyed this programme, you might like to try other Radio 4 podcasts, including Start the Week and a weekly highlight from Radio 4's evening arts programme, Front Row. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.